You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
No! Are you not entertained?
I don't know who you are.
Why so serious?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
Snap out of it!
Call me Mr.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
No!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. I solved fake murders with my friends, hung out with my favorite infant, and I guess her mom was there too, got ahead on scripts for the first time in months, and worked endlessly, so par for the course for my life, frankly. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got The Fall Guy and the 25th anniversary of Star Wars, Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. Fall Guy falls, no pun intended, under the work clause in that I don't specifically review work movies, but it's super fun and it's a love letter to movie making and especially stunt performers. Highly, highly recommend it if you want to get an idea of kind of how camaraderie is on a set. It's not exact, but it's closer than most other films are. And it was just a really, really fun movie and chemistry's great. Had a great time. And then there's, you know, Star Wars, The Phantom Menace. It's Star Wars. You can't go wrong with Star Wars. But I mean, this movie came out when I was 9, I think, and, you know, was obsessed with it. The little Anakin guy, I think him and I are like the same age thereabouts. And yeah, it just hit all the right nostalgia notes. When this releases, it's going to be May the 5th. So May the 4th, I'm actually recording this on Friday night. May the 4th, I'm going to the Academy Museum. I think I went last year, or if not the year before, and they do like a whole Star Wars May the 4th event there. So I'm going to go check that out. But yeah, it was fun, and it's great to see Star Wars on a big screen. It's how it's supposed to be seen. It was great. Also, the visual effects are very dated now, but it's a 25-year-old movie, so what are you going to do? Also, I have a comedy show tomorrow night. I have a big day tomorrow. I gotta really make sure I get this done tonight. My Criterion pick of the week is Spy number 260, which is Eyes Without a Face. The film is about a doctor who abducts women that look like his daughter to extract their faces, to put their face on his daughter's face, because hers was horribly disfigured in, I think it was a car accident. Eyes Without a Face is a cornerstone for the horror genre. The horror elements are crazy and definitely inspired a bunch of other scary movies since it was released in 1960. If you're a horror movie fan, this is an absolute necessary thing to get your eye holes on. And now on to this week's topic. So I've always planned, whether I've said it or not, I can't remember, to one day go back and focus more deeply on people that I cover on this podcast in like the 30 to 40 minute episodes, as it's very rare to get super deep in that time. But like I've always said, this podcast is meant to give you entry points into certain topics. It's certainly not meant to be, it's the spark notes, not the equivalency of like reading the novel. So now that we're kind of at a point where, you know, if you listen to everything, you've got a pretty good foundation about a lot of stuff. And since my metrics have been going off the rails about the original It Girl in Hollywood, thanks to a certain blonde multi-platinum recording artist releasing a song named after this person, so there's a lot of interest in this person, I figured let's lean into it and make Clara Bow the first individual that I spent a month on. This will be the first revisit, but it's also going to be very, very in depth compared to the like 25, 30 minutes I did back in January of 2022, I think it was. So it's been like 2 years. Also, I forgot everything. So if I forgot everything, I'm sure a lot of you did too, unless you just listened to it. But either way, there's a lot. Obviously, there's, you know, this is going to be 2 hours of content. There's a lot of stuff in here that we never got to even scratch the surface with back then. So I've learned a lot. I don't know why I'm trying to sell this. If you're at this point, you're listening to it. Anyway, this week, we're going to cover Clara's early life up to her first steps into Hollywood. And with that, let's take our places. It's showtime. Before she became known as the It Girl, Clara Bow was a poor, uneducated child from the seediest corners of Brooklyn. Clara Bow was the daughter of Robert Bow, who lost his mother as a toddler while she was giving birth to her 13th child. By all accounts, Robert wasn't much to look at or talk to, but he did have a rich baritone singing voice that he'd used to entertain people in the Brooklyn bars he so often frequented. Robert grew into a small man, literally and metaphorically, who had a penchant for booze and violence toward women who he used more as objects than people. His womanizing and brothel patronizing ways would ultimately lead him to the daughter of a florist named Sarah Gordon. Sarah's father was a violent drunk, and she swore to herself that she would never suffer the same fate as her mother, the life of a fractured woman who was beaten until she literally went insane. During the 1900 census, Frederick Gordon locked his wife in a closet when the counter arrived and told him that he was a widower. The six children in the Gordon household were told to corroborate that story or else. Robert had been infatuated with Sarah from afar. He lived only a few blocks away. And as the beautiful young woman's only prospect due to the family drama, which the neighbors were all too aware of, the two married in November of 1902. The marriage was not a happy one, as the two were opposite in just about every way that was important for making a marriage or just about any romantic relationship work. Likely didn't help either that they were living in a small, dingy apartment infested with vermin and disease that required them to share a toilet with at least 24 other people on their floor. The area of Brooklyn they'd moved into was considered the third most dangerous in the entire country, the second most dangerous in New York City. Since Robert was a horny little guy, Sarah was pregnant within months of them marrying. To support his growing family, he worked as a busboy in a very shitty restaurant. This first child was born premature in June of 1903 and died hours later. Sarah and Robert were unable to afford a headstone, so the child was buried in a pauper's grave. The situation repeated itself in May of 1904. Sarah almost died this time around and was told by her doctor to not try to get pregnant again, or it would surely lead to her death. She did, of course. Otherwise, this would be a weird bummer of a story to tell you and then be like, oh no, this was about Clara's aunt and uncle and not about their family. No. Yeah, you know what's about to happen. By this point, Sarah Bow was willing to die trying to have a baby, especially if it meant that death would mean an escape from her shitty husband. Robert was also sick of Sarah nagging him about money while mocking his dream of being a singing waiter. She enjoyed reminding him that he was just a busboy in a disgusting restaurant. He left her, and Sarah moved into her brother's apartment located above a Baptist church on Bergen Street with worse conditions than ever before. In July of 1905, temperatures were hitting 115 degrees on the inside, and infant mortality skyrocketed to 80%. It was during this heat wave that Clara Gordon Bow decided to make her entrance. Certain she was going to die in labor with this child, Sarah didn't even bother to call a doctor or a midwife. Instead, her clinically insane mother coached her through the birth. Sarah gave birth on Saturday, July 29th, 1905, to what appeared to be another dead baby. But as Sarah's mother shook the motionless newborn, it eventually began to wail. Both Clara and Sarah survived the birth. Robert returned and named his daughter after his wealthy sister-in-law, but Sarah and Robert believed that Clara's life would be a short one. As a result, no birth certificate was ever obtained for her. A few weeks after Clara's first birthday, her grandfather committed his wife to an asylum where she died a year later. Sarah Bow hated her father more than ever after that, but since her own husband had developed a habit of disappearing for months at a time, she didn't have much choice but to let her father move in with her and Clara. In a shocking twist, Frederick treated his granddaughter with kindness, and Clara grew closer to her grandfather than to her parents, who made it very clear they didn't really want her around. That joy would be short-lived as Frederick died after suffering a fit that occurred while pushing Clara on a swing he'd built in the apartment. Sarah would tell Clara that she'd wished it had been Clara that had died. Despite this and so much emotional trauma that you're about to hear about, Clara idolized her mother. This poor thing was a codependent mess. It's actually really quite sad. Years of poverty, illness, pregnancies, abandonment, and everything involving poverty, illness, pregnancies, and abandonment had taken a toll on Sarah. 2 years after her father died, she had a quote-unquote accident. Most biographers agree it was a suicide attempt and fell down a flight of stairs. The fall reopened a head wound she'd originally suffered as a teenager. She'd fallen out of a window at about 16. And this injury would cause Sarah to suffer from near constant seizures. The reopening of this wound, that is. Sarah would also begin disappearing for weeks on end as well. On the rare occasions that both of the elder Beaus would be present in whatever apartment they lived in at the time, violence was a guarantee. This also, of course, caused issues with Clara's development, including a stutter she'd be mocked for years. Young Clara was a very lonely, sensitive girl, very naive, who was mocked by the kids she went to school with for not just the stammer, but for her dirty, worn-out clothes as well. As the saddest, poorest girl in the neighborhood, Clara turned into a tomboy who could hold her own against even the older boys. Being tough was a necessary character trait in this neighborhood. For example, Clara's closest confidant at this time, a younger boy named Johnny, died in her arms after being set on fire. She was 9 years old when this happened, and the kid was like 6 or 7. Her prevailing memories from this time would be the torment of her classmates and the chaos of her home life. She did have one escape, though, and that was the movies. Clara fell in love with the movie stars of the day and dreamed of joining them one day up on the silver screen, a dream her mother very much discouraged because she did not want to have a whore for a daughter. Back then, it was basically like sex workers were the lowest of the low, and then actors were like a half tick above that. Sarah was bedbound by this point due to the mental issues, but could always find time in her day to shit on her daughter. Sarah was basically using Clara as a maid slash caregiver at this point, and instilled in her daughter a level of anxiety that would hang over the young girl for the rest of her life. Clara didn't want fame or fortune necessarily from becoming a movie star. She wanted a resource much more scarce in her world, love. When the Spanish influenza reached Brooklyn, Robert, now making money more steadily than he'd ever had, moved the family to southern Brooklyn near Coney Island just because the air was fresher. You know, you're on the closer to the water. The steady income coupled with the fresh sea air provided a level of stability Clara had not known since her grandfather died. Sarah, feeling briefly better, even made her daughter some new dresses and was out of the bed for the first time in months or years, depending on the source. Despite being told she was too ugly to be in the pictures by her mother, that was the new line, Clara still flirted with acting and was cast in an important role in the school play. She's about 7th, 8th grade at this point. The young teen practiced her lines over and over, and this exercise made her stutter fade away. While eagerly awaiting her stage debut, Sarah's issues returned, amplified with the disapproval of Clara's acting. In February of 1919, as Clara stood on the back porch of their apartment washing clothes, Sarah snuck up behind her and told her daughter that she was thinking about killing her and that she'd be better off dead. Sarah would have no memory of this when the fit that she was having passed. Clara told her father what had happened, and he got Sarah tested. They were basically told that she had a quote-unquote nervous disease, of which there was no treatment. But one thing was for sure, Sarah could not be left alone, certainly not with her daughter. The family moved back in with the cousins they'd lived with prior to this, taking up a single room in their brownstone. Clara never got to finish 8th grade, nor would she make her stage debut in that play. Clara got work as a hot dog bun slicer, one of the very few things a teenage junior high school dropout was qualified for, and later worked briefly as a receptionist for a doctor. Through it all, her love of the motion pictures never waned. She wrote letters to the movie magazines, which she devoured voraciously, a secret she kept from her mother. In January of 1921, 15-year-old Clara got wind of a fame and fortune contest being held by one of her movie magazines. The first prize was a part in a motion picture. For a poor girl from nowhere, this was one of the only chances Clara could ever expect to get to raise her out of her situation and onto that big silver screen. just one problem, other than the fact that she couldn't tell her mother what was happening. For her entry, Clara required 2 photos of herself, which she did not have. She went to her father, who secretly took her to get those 2 portraits cheaply taken at Coney Island. She hated the way she looked in them. They couldn't afford to get other ones, but opted to proceed with the entry anyway. Clara hand-delivered her entry to the magazine's New York headquarters, and the manager that had accepted her entry wrote at the bottom of her pictures, "Called in person, very pretty." Months later, in September, Clara was one of 10 finalists of the contest, much to her surprise. She'd gone through weeks of eliminations, during which Clara wore the same dress, her only dress, to each session. During the final test, Clara watched the 9 others carry out the required screen test, which included picking up a phone, looking scared, and laughing, remembering each note that was given to the other girls who had all eagerly wanted to go first. When it was the 16-year-old's turn, she took those notes she heard from the others and her years of emulating Mary Pickford and wowed the judges. After that final audition, Clara returned home to find her mother hunched over in a chair. When she asked her daughter where she'd been, Clara told her the truth. Sarah immediately fell out of the chair, having fainted. When she regained consciousness, she promptly informed her daughter that she was going to go to hell. Clara burst into tears and swore off acting because of the hurt it had caused her mother. 3 days later, Brewster Publications announced its 1921 Fame and Fortune contest winner. It was Clara Bow. Her retirement from acting lasted about 72 hours. The first step for Clara was to replace the cheap photos she had submitted with her application for professional ones that would run in the January 1922 edition of the magazine. To look more the part of a burgeoning movie star, Clara used funds that had been given to her to travel, which she obviously had needed since she already lived in New York, to buy herself a fancy new outfit in the hopes to secure a role. For a brief moment, nothing really happened until the film Beyond the Rainbow came her way. Upon seeing her, the director of this film called her fat to her face. She was 17 and still had her baby face. She was not fat, not that it matters, and the girl ran out in tears. The Brewster people persuaded the director to hire Clara after promising free publicity for the film. He ultimately agreed, and a role was written for Clara as the lead's little sister, and Clara would get $50 for a week's work. It's about $930 today. But there was a catch. Clara needed to provide her own wardrobe, which is not a crazy thing even now for up-and-coming actors, and she would not be paid until she did the work, so she didn't have money to get these outfits. Clara had one new outfit, but the other 3, yeah, she had no way to get those. She went to her wealthy aunt that she was named after for a loan, but the aunt threw her out of her house and told Robert that Clara was a disgrace to the family. Ultimately, another cousin would lend her $80 for the dresses. How much did a dress cost back in 1922? My God. Because it's like $80. So 50 was 930. Like 80 would be like, what, $1,200, $1,300 for 4 dresses? Like, I mean, I guess Target didn't exist back then. I don't know. That just seems like a lot of money for a dress. If you're trying to get 4 really quick. But I guess fast fashion wasn't a thing yet. Anyway, Clara's first day on Beyond the Rainbow started out rough. When she got to the dressing room, there were 4 other actresses that were already there. Clara had never used makeup before, and she had to do her own makeup. And when she asked them to help her apply it, all 4 actresses refused, telling her that they'd learned it on their own, and she was just going to have to do the same thing. An attempt was made, but she had apparently caked on so much grease paint to her face, she looked like a clown, which pissed the director who hadn't wanted her in the first place off even more. He demanded she cry on cue, certain that this clown that had shown up on his set wouldn't be able to do so, but was shocked when Clara burst into tears as instructed. She'd later state that in order to do this was like one of her big selling points, is the girl could just like burst into tears on a dime. All she had to do in order to do this was think of her home life, which is so sad. But yeah, she impressed. But after rapping on Beyond the Rainbow, Sarah's verbal threats became more than just verbal threats. One night in late January, early February of 1922, Clara was awoken from a dead sleep to find her mother leering over her, a butcher knife gleaming in one hand. Sarah told her that she was going to kill Clara and put the knife against her daughter's throat. Before anything further could happen, Sarah fainted. The next morning, she had no memory of the incident, and Clara's lifelong battle with insomnia was born. The threats continued as Clara's film debut loomed. That debut ended in disappointment, as Clara's scenes were cut from the film when it released in mid-February 1922. Movies had a very quick turnaround back then because no sound, black and white. All you gotta do is cut it together and copy it. Clara had not known that she was cut from the film and had taken two girls from school that had been bitches to her to gloat, only to be let down once more. One day, though, Clara would become famous enough, and this film would actually be reissued with her scenes added back in. She was even billed above the film's actual lead when this happened. But back in February of 1922, Clara was let down, of course, and she secretly hoped that the knowledge that she'd not appeared in the film would lessen the tension at home. It did not. Sarah had come to the conclusion that she needed to kill her daughter before Clara tried to appear in another movie. This time, she chased her daughter around their apartment with a butcher knife before kicking her out of the house. Clara wandered the neighborhood for a couple of days until her father found her and brought her home. Not wanting to care for his wife, nor did he want his daughter saddled with the responsibility, so a week after Clara's disappointment, Robert committed Sarah to the same asylum that her mother had died in. Robert and Clara moved to a new apartment, and Clara continued to pursue film work. This would ultimately lead her to the office of director Elmer Clifton, who was looking for a young, financially cheap actress for his film. When Clara showed up, he thought she was much older than her 16 years, as she'd borrowed a dress to make herself older and once again had smothered her face in makeup. When Clifton claimed the actress was too old for the part, as he did not believe her when she told him that she was just 16, Clara ran out, took off the makeup, and returned in her own threadbare dress and fresh face. Impressed by her scrappiness and natural beauty, the director hired her for a two-week trial period at a salary of $35 per week. Those 2 weeks quickly turned into 13, and Clara appeared in the film Down to the Sea in Ships as the younger tomboy sister of the film's heroine. Clara was depicted as a brash, stocky girl, again, not fat, just baby-faced, who beats up the boys but can also pass for one when she stows away on a whaling ship to escape her Quaker family. Clara's 13 weeks on the Massachusetts shoot were plagued with insomnia, and when she did manage to sleep, her dreams were haunted by her mother and the butcher knife. Despite this, when Clara got back home from the shoot, she begged her father to let her mother come home. He refused. Clara appealed to several relatives, ultimately leading to Sarah being released and marked as quote-unquote recovered. Clara rented the two of them a furnished apartment and told friends that she'd not been in an asylum, rather on location with Clara. Sarah now dealt with her daughter's career, which she was still fully against, by ignoring it. Clara continued bouncing around auditioning for the rest of the year until Cosmopolitan Pictures, which was owned by William Randolph Hearst, hired her as an uncredited extra for Enemies of Women. While shooting, her mother demanded to go with her to the studio, but when Clara refused, Sarah screamed that it was because her daughter was ashamed of her. Sarah then went into a catatonic state, interrupted only by spells of terrifying gasping, and she just spent like days on the couch like this. Sarah returned to the asylum on New Year's Eve and labeled terminally insane. 43-year-old Sarah Beau died 6 days later, one day before she was set to return to the facility her mother had died in. Graveside at the Staten Island funeral, Clara, who'd not shed a tear to this point, tried to jump in the grave after her mother. Clara tried to retire from acting, but her father dissuaded her, as she had now become the primary wage earner for the family. Down to the Sea in Ships premiered 2 months after Sarah's death. Critics hated the film, but loved Clara. It looked like her dreams might come true after all. And not long after that, she fell in love for the first time. His name was Arthur Jacobson, and he was a 21-year-old second cameraman with an Ivy League education. He was tall, he was handsome, he was manly, and was a member of the Film Guilds, a group of similarly educated individuals who made independent films. Clara was cast in their fourth film, Grit, which was written by F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Clara played the love interest of this film. Jacobson had shot her screen test, and within days, they were in love. Soon after, they were devising ways to be intimate without Robert, who was now very protective of his daughter, three guesses why, from interfering. While shooting Grit, which would also be critically panned, save for Clara's performance, the actress was introduced to Jack Bachman of Preferred Pictures, an independent studio in Hollywood. Clara was offered a 3-month trial period there for $50 a week, which she accepted. Soon, with her newly minted agent Maxine Alton in tow, the 17-year-old made the trek west. Upon leaving, Robert barely told his daughter goodbye. After a journey west in which she learned more about the world than she'd ever had in her small corner of the world, Clara made it to Hollywood. Hollywood was a booming movie town by the time her feet hit California soil in 1923. Hollywood, at this point, now boasted 1 million residences, and the city was well on its way to becoming the metropolis it is today. Hollywood had also been going through a series of scandals and major image problem. By this point, they've already gone through the Fatty Arbuckle rape accusations. There was the unsolved murder of William Desmond Taylor and a few others that we'll get to somewhat day. But those are the two I've covered in the podcast so far. Like, they are just mired in like murders and bad stuff. And like all this stuff about how many drugs everybody was doing all the freaking time was coming out. It was a bad image because Americans, especially back then, very, very, very buttoned up for the most part. The movie moguls, fearful that their 35 million weekly attendees would stop going to the movies if they thought it was just made by like icky people. I can't think of a better term than icky people right now. Ultimately set up a censorship board to ensure that at the very least, the content on the screens was squeaky clean. Also, the actors would have to have a morality clause put into their contracts in an attempt to keep them in line. We'll get into some of the stuff on Clara's a little later on. Preferred Pictures, Clara's new home studio, was a teeny tiny little guy at the time, specializing in minor talent and bare bones budgets for their films. The studio head, B.P. Schulberg, had reservations about this new talent upon first seeing Clara, just off the train, mind you, so very, very travel worn. But the second a camera was put on her and she began to perform, all of those doubts faded away. Clara and Alton, who was acting kind of as her guardian at this point, moved into an apartment on Hollywood and Hudson, and Alton kind of became a mother figure for the budding actress. When Clara's boyfriend, miserable back in New York, followed Clara west, Alton would now be the one that ran interference as much as possible to ensure that Clara thrived at Preferred. Well, kind of. Clara's first gig in Hollywood was a loan out to First National Pictures for the film Black Oxen. The film was about plastic surgery, and Clara played a key supporting character similar to the role she'd had in Maytime. She was so good in this film that First National borrowed her immediately for Painted People. As a result, Clara's $50 a week salary quadrupled, and she and Alton moved into a bungalow. Jacobson was banned by Alton from moving in there with them despite Clara wanting him to. Clara quit the film Painted People about 3 weeks in, realizing she'd been miscast and was having issues with the film's star, who just so happened to be married to the film's director. No conflict of interest there that I can see. The star, Colleen Moore, had banned Clara from getting close-ups because she wanted to be the only actress that was seen up close. She did not want to be upstaged, and that is a great way to do that, frankly. In a rage, Clara stormed out of the house, went to a doctor, and somehow managed to get surgery for a sinus condition that she'd been dealing with, and I don't know how she got it done at nighttime, but she got it done at nighttime. Her face was now covered in bandages, and because she, you know, had a jacked up face, she managed to pull out of the film, and that caused it to then run over budget and behind schedule. The cheek of this 17-year-old, my goodness. Clara also wanted her dad to be sent for, but Alton kept running interference on this as well. In hindsight, this was definitely a way to control the young starlet. Not the first, not the last time that's happened in her life. But it got a little bit easier because one day Clara walked in on Alton and her boss Schulberg going at it, and this gave Clara the ammunition to rid herself of Alton and finally send for Robert. Black Oxen, upon its release in December 1923, had put the fifth-billed Clara on the map in Hollywood. This was cemented after she was declared one of the, and I hate this name, baby stars of 1924 by the Western Association of Motion Picture Advertisers. At least it was boys and girls, but I hate when people infantilize young women. It's creepy. One of the books I read compared the attention behind this distinction akin to winning an Oscar, and there was even a gala to boot, which allowed the baby stars to meet their older, more established cohorts. After that, Clara's star began to rise fast. She made 8 films her first year, none of which were for her home studio. Robert had made it to Hollywood by this point, and Clara, he, and Jacobson now shared a home. Robert established himself as his daughter's business manager, much to the chagrin of the Hollywood people in charge of Clara's public persona. Robert was a drunk, and a weird dude at that, and the studio would go out of their way to ensure he wasn't around. He was also, I think if I remember correctly, like dirty all the time. Like, you have a there's definitely a bathtub in that nice house. At one point, this dude went out for a soda and came back with a literal wife. Clara, upon meeting her, threw this woman out of the house. Robert and she divorced within the month, and Clara was held financially responsible for the whole mess, including alimony. Clara's love life wasn't going much better. By the end of 1924, she and Jacobson had become more friends than lovers, and he moved out of the house. Clara's career only continued to heat up, though. The actress got rave reviews in the otherwise critically loathed Capital Punishment, which Schulberg made at Preferred to make a statement on the death penalty. Right after that, she appeared in Kiss Me Again, which was directed by Ernst Lubitsch, whose quote-unquote touch with sexually overtoned content made him a headache for the censors, but a dream for lovers of the salacious. Instead of being rewarded for these hits, Preferred continued to give Clara mediocre roles at her home studio. Schulberg slammed the actress into 16 films over the following 18 months and kept her at her now measly salary compared to her star power. Clara was becoming a massive box office draw, but was not getting the paydays to back that up. These movies were not good, and Clara knew that she was being exploited, but there wasn't a whole hell of a lot she could do. She was under contract. Schulberg also decided at some point during this time to stop lending Clara out, despite the money he was banking doing so, and began working her from 6 a.m. on Monday to midnight, 6 days a week, so Monday through Saturday. During this time, she had a great relationship with the crews on the sets. She was respected for her work ethic and overall sounded pretty much beloved by like the people that worked on the set. Most importantly, she didn't seem to have that movie star temper. Despite this, she continued to be mistreated by the people around her in power. She was having affairs with men on the set because she was lonely, including with Schulberg's brother, who was a prop master, if I'm remembering correctly. Clara's boss, Schulberg, was a sexual deviant of the highest order, by the way, and was jealous that Clara wouldn't give him the time of day in that way, and basically imported a woman for his brother to marry, I think to kind of get back at her, and he was also like jealous. This was a nice Jewish girl to replace the naive Gentile girl from Brooklyn. This left Clara unmoored and frustrated in her career and her life. But a change was on the horizon, a role that would rocket her into the stratosphere of the Hollywood elite. And that's going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media where I also post photos when I remember. I've been really, really bad about that. I'm sorry. At Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account, which I do update, which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out. The link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there. So if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I've also got the Buy Me a Coffee, where you buy me a coffee. If you did it in the last week, I have not checked the emails. I'll give you a shout out next week. I have also got merch. Check it out at the link in the show notes. Next week, Clara Bow, Hollywood starlet on the rise. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, that's a wrap.